Questions about anything? So people did really well on the winter hexagon stars for 40 points. So that's looking good then for exam three, because that almost, it could be any of those constellations, but it's always been the winter hexagon, just because there's so many nice stars to test you on. Pretty much a sure thing that that'll be one of the 10-point questions on exam three on Friday, which will cover the planets through chapter 14. Usually we try and have a help session, with opportunity when you can ask questions together, which shouldn't mean you shouldn't ask questions in my office, right? I think the best way to study for the exam is to go over the old exam, write out your answers, bring it in, and talk to me about it. But we can also get together, typically the day before or the day before the exam, typically kind of before dinner or after dinner, and usually we vote. So you want to do it next time or vote this time? Now is a good a time as any. So who's for Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Yeah, it looks like Thursday. Yeah, it's Wednesday. So kind of the big question, I think, is whether it's before dinner or after dinner.
What time?
Well, so I guess I would think, I mean, as it gets, so probably after dinner is kind of like 8 or 8:30, something like that, so that it's kind of dark outside. And before is probably like 4 o'clock or something like that. So who's for 4? Yeah, okay. Who's for 8? Something like that. Okay. So it looks like 4 p.m. here on Wednesday. If you've looked at the write-up, your calculations and stuff for your home lab, those are due on Friday. But I won't make them due unless we get a clear day between now and Friday, and it's not really looking good. So I'll probably, unless we get between now and Friday a nice clear night, we'll postpone that to maybe Monday or something like that. According to that weather forecast that I just pulled up, Friday itself is supposed to be nice, but it's already too late to help us for turning it in on Friday. Questions? So this is the weather map for today, right? You may notice we're having unusual weather. So if we kind of put together what we know, you can see these are the isobars, the levels of constant pressure. So here we've got 1,020 and 1,020 again, 1,610. So we're going to lower pressures here at 996. There's a low pressure system over kind of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And we have a big pressure difference here in Minnesota. So big pressure differences correspond to big winds, but not in the obvious direction, right? Pressure is trying to fill in this low. Pressure is trying to push air from west to east, but that's not the way the wind is blowing now, right? The wind is blowing from the north, right? So what's happening is we have a balance of forces. We have the wind blowing from the north. Coriolis force is fighting the pressure force. The Coriolis force is pushing to the right, so it's a force that's pointing towards the west. The pressure force is pushing to the east, and we have a force balance that's creating our strong winds today. So if you go to Texas or something now, they're not going to have very strong winds because they don't have very big pressure gradients. So when we have steep pressure gradients, we have big pressure forces, and it takes big Coriolis forces to balance them, so we get big winds. And again, the wind doesn't blow in the obvious direction, right? It doesn't. Water goes from high pressure to low pressure in pipes, but you can see that the air is not going from high pressure to low pressure in the Earth's atmosphere. So that's all geostrophic balance. That what we expect to observe is some sort of balance situation, because if we were out of equilibrium, the situation would be accelerating, and it would be over kind of before you could measure it. So we expect to see things in equilibrium, and a balance between Coriolis force and pressure seems to be the right thing.
So 1,000
is close. So What's normal is, I guess, part of the question. So usually we talk about sea level pressure. And you can see out here in the sea level, the pressure is a little bit more than 1,000. So these things are in, I think these things are in millibars. They might be in decapascals. But they're basically in millibars, and standard pressure is a little bit more, like this 102 sort of number. So in the metric system, we're talking about pressures as forces per area. So if we were talking English, we'd be talking about PSIs. But actually, typically, weather meteorologists here usually describe the pressure in terms of inches of mercury. That is to say, what height of mercury has a pressure that's equivalent to atmospheric pressure. And those are numbers typically around 30 inches. But in the metric system, we'd be measuring it in forces, newtons per square meter. And it turns out that atmospheric pressure is about 100,000 pascals per square meter. And these things are, and I think that's the 102. And these things are actually in, I'm pretty sure, in millibars, where a bar is kind of the metric equivalent. Well, I think it's 100,000 pascals. More questions?
Yes, question. So then what is the air actually doing? Is it spinning in a circle because it's going down into Minnesota?
Well, so kind of to first approximation, it's you would think it would be going down, right? So it's like a lake level that is low here. There's less air here than there is over there. In any natural sort of situation, you would think that things are going to level out, that this low pressure system should be filling up. But we see that that's not what's happening. What's happening more than anything else is that the air is going around these high and low pressure systems. It's not actually filling it up. Now, this is an idealization. Actually, the air does go a little bit in while going mostly around. So over time, these low pressure systems, due to viscosity, will fill up. So these low pressure systems don't last forever the way they seem to on Jupiter. They have, you know, a lifetime of a week or something like that before they're filled up. But in the geostrophic approximation, the winds are going around, they're not going in. So these are kind of the principles we've been using to describe meteorology that apply generally on all the planets. So on Venus, the Coriolis force is basically zero, so we don't have geostrophic balance, we have cyclostrophic balance, where we're balancing the centrifugal force and pressure. But recently we've been talking about the giant planets, which are fast spinning planets, so they have an even larger Coriolis force than Earth. So we've got the thermal winds, and they're really the key to what's happening on the giant planets in terms of zones and belts. So we were thinking about this in terms of jet streams in the Earth's atmosphere, where we have cold air in the north, and we have hot air in the equator. Hot air is low density air. So as you go up in the atmosphere, low density air means the pressure isn't going to change as much. So if we go up, you know, a kilometer in this hot air, we're down to 900 millibars, whereas if we go up in this cold air, we're down to 800 millibars. So automatically, on top of cold air, we're going to have low pressure as opposed to high pressure. So generally speaking, there's a pressure force, not on the surface of the planet where we've got basically equal pressures, but up high, we're going to have a force that's pushing air, you know, from the United States into Canada, pushing north. And so we're going to have a balance of forces. The air is going to have to be moving quickly to the east, so its Coriolis force to the south is going to balance this pressure force. So that's how we were talking about it in terms of Earth. But we've got the same sort of situation for the giant planets, except repeated lots and lots of times. So for the Earth, we've got, roughly speaking, three Hadley cells per hemisphere. And again, on Earth, These things are not at all obvious. They're only kind of obvious on average, where we see that there is hot air that is rising at the equator and it's falling at these kind of plus minus 30 degrees latitudes, and it's rising here at 60 degrees, etc. Not particularly clear from looking at a picture of the Earth from space that we do have these slowly circulating cells. Incidentally, not uncommonly from space, you can see the intertropical convergence zone, which is where we have this hot rising air, which leads to lots of thunderstorms. So kind of popcorn clouds that are populating around the equator, the intertropical convergence zone. So on the giant planets, we've got the same thing repeated multiple times. We have multiple Hadley cells that are, generally speaking, horizontally convecting hot air from the equator to the poles, both directions. So we have multiple regions of rising air and falling air. And corresponding to that, automatically hot air is going to, above the surface, is going to have a higher pressure than the cool descending air. So we're going to have a pressure difference here, which is going to drive a jet stream in this boundary between the zone and the belt. And of course, the situation is going to be just reversed as we go from this belt to the following zone. So we have alternating directions of high-speed jets between these zones and belts. Well, this whole thing can get confusing because I called this hot rising air, but if we were to take a picture of Jupiter and measure the temperature of the cloud tops, we'd find that this air is colder than that air. And that's simply because here we have, I'll call it moist air, but it's not usually water that's condensing out last. Here we have moist air that's rising, and it is going to produce clouds at the highest possible level where it's cold. Those condensates will have been squeegeed out of the atmosphere. So here we have very dry air, and it's going to have to go further down before it ends up making clouds. So the cloud layer, even though this air at the same altitude is going to be colder here than there, at the cloud tops, the air is going to be hotter there than it is there. Lots of source of confusions. So Hadley cells, horizontal convection, we've got 3 per hemisphere on the Earth approximately. You might remember that on Venus we had equator to pole Hadley cells. On Mars it was a little bit tricky. On the equinoxes we had 2 equator to pole Hadley cells, whereas in the winter we had Hadley cell that basically went, well, nearly from pole to pole. So we talked about thermowind, geostrophic balance, Hadley cells, greenhouse effect. We get the temperature at the cloud tops, the effective temperature, and underneath the blanket it's going to be warmer. And we can either talk about convective heat transfer, in which we have the adiabatic lapse rate, about 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer for the Earth. Depends on the mass of the atoms and the acceleration of gravity of the planet, what the convective lapse rate is. So on the giant planets, the mass that we're talking about is about a tenth of the mass, hydrogen and helium, about a tenth of the mass of the N2 and O2 that make up the Earth's atmosphere. And G isn't 10 times bigger, so the convective lapse rate is going to be smaller, 4 degrees or so per kilometer for the giant planets. Or we can talk about radiative temperature equilibrium, where we're thinking about infrared light trying to bounce its way out of the Earth's atmosphere, having to be hotter on the bottom in order to work its way out, kind of on average. And of course, pressure is just the weight of the overlying air. So that low pressure system over Green Bay, there is simply less air over Wisconsin than there is over Minnesota. In terms of composition, the giant planets are going to be hydrogen and helium rich. We lose out on the hydrogen and helium because we are relatively hot and have a relatively high, relatively low escape velocity. So our hydrogen and helium escaped early on. Whereas the giant planets were able to grab hold and hold on to their hydrogen and helium, both because they're massive and because they're cold. Helium measures less, the atmosphere of Saturn measures less helium than the atmosphere of Jupiter. noticeably less. And the so Jupiter, roughly speaking, something like 85% hydrogen and 15% helium, whereas for Saturn, the helium percentage is more like 3 or 5%. So quite noticeably less helium in the atmosphere of Saturn. And we think that's differentiation. We think about helium as being a light gas, but compared to hydrogen, it's a heavy gas. And we know that the heavy things sink. So the explanation for the low helium concentration in Saturn is that it's dripping out into the interior. So we've talked about the zones and belts. The white zones due to the condensing ammonia in the atmosphere. Exactly what's making the belts dark is not understood, but people speculate that it's a sulfur compound just because sulfur compounds are relatively colorful, and sulfur is a fairly common element in the big scheme of things. You remember that Saturn has kind of muted. It certainly has bands and zones, but they're not particularly obvious. It's mostly kind of a yellowish color, whereas the bands and zones are very obvious on Jupiter, with white and kind of red colors alternating. Jupiter and Saturn both have good, strong magnetic fields, which requires a conducting, convecting fluid, and we think that that's liquid metallic hydrogen in the case of Jupiter and Saturn. We looked at the Great Red Spot, and the Great Red Spot is in the southern hemisphere, and it registers as a high-pressure system, whereas we think of long-lasting storms in the Earth's atmosphere being low-pressure systems. And we think that that's explained by the same sort of phenomena we were talking about below. Hurricanes on Earth, although they are low-pressure systems on the surface, have a warm core. So if you go up high enough, the low-pressure system can reverse to a high-pressure system, and the winds can actually then blow in the opposite direction around that core. So certainly it measures as a high, but lots of speculation is that if we went deep inside the atmosphere, it would be cold. And I don't know if it's a different picture or not. There's a theorem of fluid mechanics that says that under certain conditions, if you have a rotating fluid, the rotation velocity has to be cylindrically symmetric like this. So there are some people who think that that these giant atmospheres, the zones and belts might be connected between the upper and lower hemisphere. The conditions of the Taylor-Prout theorem are not actually satisfied in the atmosphere of Jupiter, so it doesn't have to be this way. And in fact, I'm not a particular believer in this sort of deep possibility. Incidentally, how are we going to know, right? We can't see deep inside the atmosphere of Jupiter. We've sent one probe into Jupiter, but pressures get extremely high. So it went to 22 times the atmospheric pressure before it was crushed in Jupiter's atmosphere, and it was not nearly deep enough to detect this sort of thing. We don't have any seismometers on Jupiter, of course, because no solid surface. So I'm not sure we're ever going to exactly resolve this situation. Oddly enough, we do have seismometers on the surface of the Sun. And oddly enough, the Sun does have differential rotation, kind of like Jupiter. So we can resolve how deep the rotation patterns go. And they don't go to the center of the planet. They go to the bottom of the convection zone. And if I were betting, I would bet that that's going to turn out to be the same way with Jupiter, but I probably won't live to win or lose that bet because we're never going to know.
So, how do we put something on the surface of the
Sun? Yeah, well, you should be wondering about that, I guess. So, did I lie? I don't know if I lied or not. So first of all, it turns out that it's surprisingly difficult to reach the surface of the Sun. So there are any number of science fiction movies where the dead hero's body is pushed towards the Sun in this nice sunset. It doesn't work that way, right? If you push it away, it's just going to go in a slightly elliptical orbit around the Sun. It's not going to drop into the Sun. You have to lose all of that orbital velocity before something's actually going to fall. So it would actually be pretty difficult. In addition to being hot, it would be hard to achieve an orbit that would put something on the surface of the sun. So nothing man-made has touched the surface of the sun or is likely to. So how can we detect vibrations on the surface of the sun the way that we do vibrations on the surface of the Earth and the way we did vibrations on the surface of the moon? It's the only other seismometers we've got. And the answer is kind of surprising, Doppler effect. So if the surface of the sun is shaking, it's a bright enough source that we can see the surface, we can see the change in color, as it were, of the surface of the sun due to these very slow velocities, and we can measure those vibration rates. So we actually have better data on the vibrations of the sun than we do on the vibrations of the Earth, because we can image the entire, we can image half of the sun at one time, and we can have the equivalent of seismic stations every place on that surface. So we actually know a great deal about the interior of the sun. And I would say things are clearer about the interior of the sun than they are about the interior of the Earth, where people still argue about exactly what the temperature is at the center of the Earth and things like that. It's hotter than the surface of the sun, but how much hotter? More questions? So we'll talk lots more about the sun, obviously, once we get this exam over. That's kind of the next thing. Okay, so you remember kind of my plan is a little bit different from the author's plan. I want to talk about all of the giant planets first and then come back and talk about kind of miscellaneous things about those planets, like the rings and the moons. So we've got two planets left, Uranus and Neptune, before we go on to the other interesting things about the giant systems. And eventually, in chapter 15, the things that aren't planets, asteroids and comets and things like that. So here's the picture for Jupiter. Right, we don't have any ozone, so we don't have any stratosphere, mesosphere sort of thing. We've got a troposphere, and we've got a thermosphere. And we've got clouds here in the troposphere that are basically 100% cloud covers. And of course, as we go up, it gets cooler. So ammonia, which we think about as being a gas, is going to be condensing at about this altitude. And here we've got ammonium sulfide condensing at this altitude, and water, which we do think is a liquid, condensing at about a little bit cooler than room temperature here. And I probably should stress, and maybe should have written on the board, that both Jupiter and Saturn, and turns out Neptune too, are not so much heated by the sun as they're heated by their internal heat sources. So the Earth is hot on the inside, and if you have very deep mines, you notice that it gets hot as you go down in the Earth. But basically, the Earth is heated by the sun. The geothermal heat from the Earth is small change compared to the sunlight from the Earth. And that's not the case for Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune. They are predominantly heated by their geological heat. And most of that heat is heat that's left over from the formation of the planet. Some of it is, of course, radioactive decay, just like it is on Earth. But the majority of it, we think, is leftover heat from the formation of the planet. So these things are all very hot on the inside, and this geological heat is escaping through the planet, and it's actually doing most of the job of heating the atmosphere of Jupiter. Okay, so if we switch over to Uranus and Neptune, kind of the big difference is that they're colder planets since they're further out. And we start to get condensations of things like methane gas. And methane, it turns out, you think about methane as being a transparent gas, like natural gas, but it actually has some absorption bands in the red. And so the red light from the sun is absorbed, which means that the blue light isn't absorbed. So both Uranus and Neptune have a very definite bluish hue to them, kind of uniform blue balls, because of this methane that's condensed in the atmosphere. And this haze is high enough. You can see it's still in the troposphere, but probably the sort of actions we were talking about for Uranus and Neptune, things like the Great Red Spot, correspond to things that are a little bit deeper. Now, as a matter of fact, there was something in Neptune's atmosphere when Voyager went by that is called the Great Dark Spot, and is very similar to the Great Red Spot. It was in the southern hemisphere. It was a high pressure system. But it didn't last 300 years, because when Hubble Space Telescope went to look for it, it wasn't there like 10 years later. So we do have weather, as it were, certainly in Neptune and probably in the rest of these guys too. So in terms of the internal composition of these giant planets, so I don't know, here's a picture I showed you long ago, maybe I'll switch in a second. So notice that Jupiter weighs something like four times what Saturn weighs, but they have pretty much the same size, physical size. Saturn has a much lower density than Jupiter has. Uranus and Neptune have kind of similar densities that aren't that different from the density of Jupiter. So because of this huge gravitational force and huge pressures, we have a relatively large amount of the liquid metallic hydrogen in Jupiter that we think is responsible for Jupiter's magnetic field. In contrast, Saturn isn't so big, so we think it has a much smaller liquid metallic hydrogen shell that's probably responsible for its magnetic field. But notice that Uranus and Neptune are small enough that they don't have the pressure that's necessary to make liquid metallic hydrogen, so we don't think that they've got, that that's the source of their magnetic fields. So backing up a step, what we have for all of these guys is a rocky core. You can see that the rocky core and when I say rocky, these things are going to be liquid because of the high temperature. You can see that the iron and silica that's at the core of Jupiter and Saturn is about the same size, something like 10 times the size of the Earth is an estimate, whereas for Uranus and Neptune, it's noticeably smaller. And it kind of makes sense. Smaller planet, no magnetic hydrogen, but these guys do have magnetic fields. But their magnetic fields are odd. I think I commented a little bit about this last time. So here's Jupiter's magnetic field. Pretty much like Earth's, so this is shown as a bar magnet, but again, these are electromagnets. So we have an electromagnet that's centered on the planet. Turns out it's reversed from Earth's, and the magnetic axis is a little bit displaced from the spin axis, just as with the Earth. For Saturn, reversed compared to the Earth, the same as Jupiter. Here the magnetic axis is actually pretty well aligned to the spin axis. And Saturn also has an axial tilt like the Earth does, so Saturn has noticeable seasons the way the Earth does, kind of in contrast to Jupiter. But look at the situation for Uranus and Neptune. So their magnetic fields are not centered on the center of the planet. And incidentally, the same thing was also true of Mercury. It was discovered in the last month. So pretty different sort of magnetic fields, and pretty big separations between the magnetic axis and the spin axis, right, for both Uranus and Neptune. And although the details certainly aren't worked out, people usually attribute this to the difference in the material that is the conducting fluid. So we've got what's sometimes called an ammonia ocean, that is to say kind of so-called ices, which aren't which are very hot, but which consist of molecules like ammonia and water and probably ions. So they're conducting fluids the same way ocean water is conducting fluids. So here's kind of the same take on these pictures. Here you might notice that these are two different calculations for the situation on Jupiter. And again, we're all talking about calculations and not measurements. So notice that they don't agree, right? So here that's 22,000 degrees Kelvin at the center of Jupiter, and here it's 16,000 degrees Kelvin at the center of Jupiter. So exactly how these interiors work is undeterminable at this point. In this model, incidentally, Jupiter is convective from top to bottom. Here there is this radiative energy transfer zone that separates an outer convection zone from an inner convective zone. Okay, this picture of Saturn shows a bigger metallic hydrogen core than the previous one did, but still smaller than it had, substantially smaller than we have for Jupiter. So Uranus and Neptune, when we get around to looking at pictures, look the same, have pretty similar masses, pretty similar density. So we're guessing, and that's a lot of what's going on, we're guessing that their insides are pretty similar. But having guessed that, do remember that there's a radical difference that we simply don't understand. Why Uranus lacks this internal heat source, whereas all the other giant planets have a strong internal heat source. So here we've got a much thicker atmosphere where we have molecules, and here's where the ices are, so-called, right? Water, ammonia, probably in ionic form. This is the conducting convecting fluid that we think is responsible for Uranus and Neptune's magnetic field. And all of this has to be built on some sort of rock, which had to attract the whole thing to begin with. And the total amount of rock exceeds what we would have for the Earth, but is small in comparison to what we had for Jupiter, just like the previous one. Okay, so none of these guys have any solid surface as you go down. This rock would be molten. It's all. So often people distinguish, and occasionally I'll distinguish between the gas giants of Jupiter, where we're dominated by hydrogen and helium, and Uranus and Neptune, where the composition is noticeably different. They have lots of hydrogen and helium, and in fact their atmosphere has pretty much the same ratio of hydrogen and helium as Jupiter has. This kind of 85%, 15% mix of hydrogen and helium. But the bulk of Uranus and Neptune is in the form of these ices there at the core. So sometimes they're called ice giants as opposed to gas giants. So here's the story on I don't know if maybe I should flash this thing first. There's this problem with Uranus and Neptune, or excuse me, with Venus and Neptune, and that is that their spin axis is tilted by more than 90 degrees. In the case of Venus, it doesn't rotate very fast, and its rotation direction is nearly reversed from the rotation direction of the rest of the planets. So it's not quite so much of a problem. But Uranus has a noticeable spin, and so the Coriolis force is going to be an important feature. But kind of unfortunately, the International Astronomical Union has defined that the northern hemisphere is going to be the one that you would see the North Star from. Meteorologists would be a lot happier if we defined the northern hemisphere as the one that's rotating the same way the north hemisphere is for us. So then I could say that in the northern hemisphere of any planet, the Coriolis force pushes to the right. And so because of this tension, people have different ways of defining directions, north, south, east, and west, for the winds on Uranus, kind of depending upon whether they're meteorologists or whether they're fans of the IUE, which I'm not particularly. So the upshot is that you'll sometimes see different pictures of the wind speeds on these planets with not necessarily clear whether these things are super rotating or not. But here are the winds on Uranus, and what we've got is at the equator, we've got a not super rotating jet, a sub-rotating jet, a jet that's rotating in the opposite direction compared to the planetary rotation as it is on all the other planets we've mentioned so far, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. So we still have these high-speed jets, and we kind of have zones and belts, but we don't have nearly as many as we have for the other planets. And the situation on Neptune is basically the same. So this is older data for Uranus, but you can see it's still the same basic story. Here's the situation on Neptune. We've got a not super rotating jet, a sub rotating jet equatorially, and we've got these high speed jet streams at kind of mid latitudes. And again, that's in contrast to what we've got for Jupiter and Saturn, where we have multiple reversals and we have a high speed equatorial jet. Okay, and Venus is kind of the reverse of this, right? We've got a big equatorial jet, but it's going in the prograde direction as opposed to the retrograde direction. So people have worked hard to explain this, and I think it's fair to say that it's pretty well understood, but not maybe not at the level of detail that would be people particularly happy with. So here's our models of the interior of these atmospheres. Again, you know, basically speaking, we don't have an ozone layer, so we have a troposphere and we've got a thermosphere. And the only difference between these guys is that we're going to colder and colder temperatures as we go further and further out. With the exception of the very, very, very similar nature of Neptune and Uranus. So Neptune is further out, it should be colder, but Neptune is the guy that has this internal heat source, whereas Uranus is basically just heated by the sun. So we have very similar atmospheres for Uranus and Neptune, except one imagines that Neptune is going to be more convective because it's got that internal heat source, which should keep things stirred up, as it were. Questions? Well, we've got one last atmosphere to talk about, and it's a matter of kind of taking things a little bit out of order. So we've got giant moons to talk about. We've talked about our moon long ago. Jupiter has four big moons, so-called Galilean moons that some of you saw through a telescope. So this is kind of what you would see blown up picture of Jupiter. This is the disk that you can see, usually with some banding in the telescope, and usually you can see all four of these moons of Jupiter. It has many more moons than these four, but these are the big giant ones. And we've got Saturn, which also has zillions of moons, but it's got one big one, Titan, that we want to talk about. And Neptune has one big moon, Triton. So those are the big moons that we want to talk about in the context of kind of chapter 13. But there's one moon that is particularly special, and that's the moon of Saturn, Titan. And it's special because it's got a big atmosphere. So all these same sorts of questions that we could ask about the other planets' atmospheres, we can ask about Titan. And the Europeans have dropped a probe in the atmosphere of Titan, so we've got pretty good data on what the atmosphere is like. So the first thing that's maybe worth commenting on is that the atmosphere of Titan is the one that's most similar to the Earth's atmosphere. It's basically a nitrogen atmosphere. Okay, so since we're starting to talk about Titan, there's kind of, might as well at the same time talk about the surface of Titan. So in visible light, Titan just looks like kind of an orangish ball. It's got 100% cloud cover. So it's really only when we use, in this case, infrared light that we can start to see some surface features on this moon. Here's kind of an overall picture of what we think the interior of Titan is like. So Jupiter and all of the giant planets have a density that's less than 2, which we take as being kind of a 50-50 mix of rock and ice. So the gas giant planets are mostly gas. And really, the size of the planet, as much as anything else, how much gravity is, determines how compressed that gas is. So Jupiter and Saturn have pretty much the same chemical composition, but Jupiter has more gravity, so it's more compressed. So Saturn has a density that's less than water, and Jupiter has a density that's more than water. And Uranus and Neptune have kind of comparable densities to the density of Jupiter. But for these moons, we're going to find pretty commonly they're kind of a mix of water and rock, and they have a density that's about 2 as a result. We probably could land seismic probes on this guy. So here's the picture of the atmosphere of Titan. So it's again a mostly nitrogen atmosphere, which we haven't talked about before, right? So we had a few percent nitrogen in Mars and Venus, and of course we have a mostly nitrogen atmosphere on Earth. But other than that, we haven't been talking much about nitrogen. So here we have a atmosphere that is 96% nitrogen and is bigger than the Earth's atmosphere. So the surface pressure on this moon is about 1.5 times the surface pressure of Earth's atmosphere. So we've got a big nitrogen atmosphere on this moon. How is it able to hold on to it? I mean, it's only a moon, so it's not going to have a huge escape velocity. Well, it's cold. And presumably it is slowly losing it, but it's cold enough that it's going to hang on to it. And the temperatures are such that we kind of have a repetition of what we have with Earth, except instead of having water be the fluid of choice, we're talking about hydrocarbons being the fluid of choice. So we're going to have methane clouds, we're going to have lakes that are of ethane and methane, so it's, you know, it's kind of a gasoline sort of planet. The possibility of volcanism, which in this case means things like water coming out of volcanoes, ices coming out of volcanoes as opposed to rock coming out of volcanoes, is somewhat speculative, but the impact craters, so remember we can date surfaces based on the number of impact craters, very few impact craters have been imaged on Titan, and so surface seems to be fresh, and presumably that means some sort of volcanism, although not uncommonly people think it might just be erosion. So there also aren't a lot of craters in the continental United States, right? Because we've got water that's running over the craters and filling them in over time. So maybe there's erosion from this gasoline, as it were, that's raining out occasionally in Titan. So this haze is really keeping us from seeing the surface very well. We did that one. So this is a mosaic, and of course it's a false color image, so it's not really that they have these blue lakes, but if you look carefully, and I think I can look carefully, you can see there are these dendritic patterns which look all the world like rivers. And we do know that these are big flat areas, and we've seen them grow and shrink when clouds go over them. So. And the temperatures are such that it's not water. Water would be a rock at these temperatures. So this is almost certainly ethane and methane lakes that come and go. So the Europeans landed one probe on the surface, and this is kind of what they saw. Maybe I should have used the image enhanced region of it, but I think you can kind of see there's a mix of dirt and rocks. Those rocks are probably ice, probably not silicate rocks. Expanding it doesn't help that much. Okay, so we've got an atmosphere. It's been one of the focuses of the Cassini-Huygens probe, which is a joint project between European Space Agency and the United States. So they've done a fair amount of work, but they haven't, you know, it will take a kind of a separate probe to get down the details of this. In terms of the meteorology of the planet, it looks like So we do see clouds, we do see things that certainly look like rain, we see these lakes grow and shrink. It looks like we have Hadley cells, but Hadley cells that span from pole to pole as opposed to going through the equator. I think I have, do I have transparencies that show the same thing, better or worse? Yeah, I thought I did, but they're not making themselves manifest. So questions on atmospheres of the any of the planets for that matter? So in some sense, the one that's most similar to us is Titan, right? With this nitrogen atmosphere with a hydrological cycle, but one that is not based on water, one that's based on methane. And Mars, which is pretty similar to the Earth, except there just isn't that much atmosphere there. So they have clouds in kind of minor sorts of forms. So what I want to talk about next is probably the most striking feature of the giant planets, and that's the rings. So the rings are just zillions of rocks and icebergs that are orbiting around the central body. And Saturn is the one that is most famous for this, for having rings. So Galileo barely made out these rings. It took a while for people to kind of believe that that's what, I mean, it's such an incredible idea that you have this very, very, very thin, much, much thinner than anything you could name, rings of individual icebergs, in the case of Saturn, that are orbiting around the planet. So here we have kind of a mosaic of the rings of Saturn, which are the most prominent ones. And if you look in detail, kind of the most striking thing is that the rings are not at all uniform. They're made out of probably millions of ringlets, where we have some concentrations and ring gaps. Right, so this thing is called the Cassini division, but in this particular picture you can see that there is stuff even in the Cassini division. So there's more of this zillions of ringlets that actually make up the rings of Saturn. So one of the things that causes these gaps in the rings is little moons. And you can see here's this little moon that has cleared out this gap in the D-rings of Saturn. And you can see that as this thing goes by, it kind of causes waves in the zillions of particles that are making up the rest of the rings. So if one guesses what's making this little gap, it's probably just a moon that's similar to this one, except a whole lot smaller. There's another process that can make gaps in rings, and it's called resonance. So if we have a situation where you have one of the major moons of Saturn that takes maybe twice as long to go around as the ring particle you're talking about, there will be a constant perturbation occurring every time that moon goes by on the ring particle. And these sort of resonances are able to clear out gaps in the rings also. I think we look, I don't know, I guess this is a different side of Jupiter, but of Saturn, but it looks pretty much the same. So here again, the rings, and there are these extended rings that are around it. One important feature is whether we're looking at the rings in backscattered light, which of course we can't do except from spacecraft. That requires us to be on the other side of Saturn from the sun, or whether we're looking at forward scattered light. So some of these gaps look different according to whether we're looking at forward scattered light or backscattered light. Okay, so Saturn has the most obvious rings, but all of the giant planets have rings. So if we look at Jupiter, there's going to be a ring of Jupiter. So you're never going to see this from the Earth. It's in this. So in the case of Saturn, the material that's in the ring is ice, and it's highly reflective. For the other rings, it's made out of darker material, and so they're seen only with great difficulty, and they're best seen looking back on the planet as opposed to forward on the planet. So here we have the very minor ring of Jupiter in comparison to Saturn's magnificent rings. I don't know if there's a picture that has all of them together or not. I don't see it. Okay, so there's Jupiter's small dusty ring. Then we've got Uranus's rings. So Uranus's rings were discovered before spacecraft reached Uranus, and they were discovered by carefully monitoring the light of a star as Uranus went in front of it. The reason people were doing that was to get a good diameter of Uranus. But before Uranus was supposed to block out the light of the star, they saw a series of dips in the light of that star that had to do with the occultation of the rings and the star. And they matched on either inside and outside. So people saw that they were rings. So here again, we see it in forward scattering and back scattering. You can see that the look of the rings is different. This is the way you would see them from Earth, and this is what you would look if you were looking beyond, if you were looking back from beyond beyond Uranus at the rings. And you can see here there doesn't look to be much between these two spots, but here there is in fact material that's filling this ring. The other thing you'll notice is that a lot of these rings match up from one side to the other, but here the epsilon ring, it has a distinctly different radius at these two different locations. So it's not a circular ring, it's an elliptical ring. So these are more pictures of the, again, this material, all the material except for Saturn's rings is relatively dark. So another thing to notice is that Saturn's rings are mostly ring with some gaps, whereas these other rings we've been looking at are mostly gaps with some rings. So here's the naming system for these rings. They were named originally in Greek letters according to their discovery, but now they're all kind of out of order compared to their distance from the planet. Okay, so Uranus's rings, dark rings, mostly gap, some ring, dark material just like on Jupiter. Incidentally, probably bigger material. The material on Jupiter looks to be more dust in size. The material in Saturn's rings ranges from kind of iceberg size to snowflake size. So there's a huge range of ice for that one. So what's funny about Neptune's rings is that they are not uniform. We have what are called arcs. So here you can see that there's more material concentrated there than there is there. So here's kind of the naming scheme. They actually had names for these various pieces of the arc rings. So I think this might be a Hubble Space Telescope picture where we've blocked out, of course, the very bright light from Neptune itself. Now, we got these giant moons, and I said that Titan had a very big atmosphere that's worth talking about. It turns out that Triton, the moon of Neptune, seems to also have an atmosphere. And if we look at this guy, you can see that there is, I hope you can see, that there is some atmosphere, some cloud in the atmosphere of Triton. But it's really not worth. So again, Titan's atmosphere is bigger than the Earth's atmosphere. So this Triton's is kind of not worth talking about. But while we're here, if we look at Triton, we do see craters, but we see few of them. So remember that the amount of cratering gives us a hint as to how old the surface is. So this is must be a fairly young surface, kind of a mottled surface. And you see these regions where there, you know, for all intents and purposes, looks like there is windblown material. So those are geysers that are coming up from the surface. That are making these streaks. So Triton is a geologically active place, as we'll learn that's true of lots of the rings, lots of the moons of these planets. And that should worry you a little bit, because we've said that kind of size determines geological activity. How much heat depends on the mass-volume ratio, so that a spark from a grindstone is going to cool off almost immediately. A hard-boiled egg is going to hold its heat for a while, and a planet is going to hold its heat for a lot longer. And the bigger the planet, the longer it's going to hold its heat. And so as a result, it's going to be more geologically active. And we'll see probably next time that the moons of Jupiter are counterexamples that need to be explained. Okay, so here's the big picture of all of these rings. And all of these rings have been scaled to the size of the planet, right? So Jupiter is a bigger planet, so its rings are overall bigger. But here we've scaled everything to the size of the planet to kind of put all of these rings in perspective. So again, Neptune, we've got these ring arcs. Uranus, we've got these stable rings that are mostly gap. These are all, dark rings. And we have the bright rings of Saturn that also have various gaps and separations that lead to these separations. So why is it that you can make such a picture? Why is it that the rings, here's kind of another picture. Why is it that the rings can be scaled to the size of the planet? And they all fit in kind of this nice situation. So what we have, it's being called there the tidal stability limit, but Roche is the guy who came up with this, so it's usually called the Roche limit. So the Roche limit is as close as you can get to a planet without breaking up. So let's talk some about that. So if here's our planet, and let's say we have two close together rocks. Are those rocks going to fall together because of their mutual gravitational force, or are they going to separate out? So what's the force that's going to be pulling these guys together? Well, just to make the kind of calculation simple, let's assume these both have some mass m, and they're separated by some distance that I'll call d. Then the gravitational force between these two is going to be given by Newton. The product, let me use a lowercase m here, the product of the masses divided by their distance squared. On the other hand, this guy here is going to feel a bigger force from the planet than this guy here. So there's going to be a difference in force. How can we calculate that difference in force? Well, it's going to depend on the mass of the planet and the mass of the chunk And we have two different chunks, and we're interested in the difference between the force on this guy and the force on that guy. And if you know some calculus, you can take the derivative of Newton's formula and come up with that relationship. In the end, you don't need to worry about any of this, I guess, except the final result. Notice that the G's cancel out, one of the masses of those guys cancel out, and we have the separation between our pieces divided by their distance squared. And I'm going to throw out this 2 for reasons that and just to make this into a nice formula, let me divide by the radius of the planet cubed. So what I've got here is the mass per size of the two pieces. So let me call that the density of the ring material. And here I have the mass over the radius of the planet. Let me call that the density of the planet's material. And here I have the ratio of the size of the planet to the distance that the ring is cubed. So if we just rearrange this, the distance at which we have this force balance is given by the radius of the planet and the cube root of the ratio of the density of the ring material to the density of the planet. Now, I've done this in a pretty crude way intentionally. If we do a better job, we kind of get 2.5 in there. That is to say that if the ring material has the same density as the planetary material, we expect that the rings will, that a planetoid would break up if it were within 2.5 times the radius of the planet. And that's what this tidal stability limit is. So things should break apart if they're inside this limit. So the space station is 100 miles up. The radius of the planet is 6,000 miles, so it's way inside the tidal stability limit. So why doesn't the space station break up? Well, because it's riveted together, right? It's held together as a solid hunk. But if you were to let a brick sit on the surface of the space station, it would float away. It wouldn't be tied to the space station. So if you have, as you do, this moon that is inside the tidal stability limit, if you put a brick on the surface of this moon, it's not going to stay there. It's going to float off. So just as the space station is a one homogeneous piece that's stuck together, this moon better be one homogeneous piece that's stuck together. But as we chip pieces off such a moon, they're not going to return to the surface of that moon. They're going to fly out and form these sort of rings. Okay, so we really don't expect rings outside of the Roche limit, and we don't find rings outside of the Roche stability limit. And presumably what's happening is we have planetoids that are coming inside of that limit and are colliding with each other to chip off various pieces, which then go to form these rings. Best guess is the smallest of these pieces do not last very long before they are either broken even further apart or spiral into the planet. So one of the problems to explain is how these rings manage to stay around for long periods of time. And presumably it's because they have big bodies embedded in them, from which pieces are constantly being chipped off. And I think it's for Neptune that they see a noticeable decrease in the intensity of the rings just over the time that they've been measured, which is just a few decades. So these rings probably are replenished occasionally. They're not long lasting, meaning billions of year long features of the solar system. Okay, so all the planets have rings. They're all a little bit different. They all are inside this Roche limit, which defines where moons would break apart if they're not riveted together. Saturn has the most impressive rings, which are ice rings. All the other rings are made out of darker material. And the generally speaking, the rings become mostly gap as opposed to solid rings. I say solid, but what we have for Saturn is not a solid ring here in the B ring, but really just zillions of little ringlets that are so tightly spaced that it looks more or less like a solid ring, unless you have a spacecraft going by. Okay, so I think I've said before that sometimes you see numbers for the moons of Jupiter in the 60s. It goes up years to year, but it really, basically, all of these guys have an infinite number of moons, because all of these rings are little particles that are in orbit around the corresponding planet. And it's just a matter of how small a thing we can observe and end up calling it a moon as opposed to a ring particle. So what's left for next time? Well, we want to talk about then more about these giant moons. So here's kind of the systematics of these moons. So we've got the four giant moons of Jupiter: Io, Callisto, Titan, Ganymede. Oops. Io, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede. Titan is, as we said, a moon of Saturn. I guess they've put them in order of their overall size. So notice that these guys are, generally speaking, bigger than the moon. And if we look at the densities, generally speaking, we've got densities that are more like 2 as opposed to the moon, which has, among the terrestrial planets, this guy was the lowest, right? Generally speaking, terrestrial planets had a density more like 5 as opposed to 3.3, Mars being the second lowest at about 4. So we've got some exceptions, though. We've got Io and Europa, which have fairly rocky constituents, as opposed to these things that are about 2, which seem to be kind of a rock-ice 50-50 mix. And incidentally, Pluto would also fit in this categorization of having a density pretty much about 2, and is also pretty much in this same size range. So what's going to be important about these guys is that they are, a lot of them are, geologically active. And we're going to need to see how that could be the case, because they're comparable in size of the moon, and we know the moon was geologically dead a billion years after it was formed. So why haven't these guys cooled off and have just as uninteresting geology as the moon has? Okay, so see you Wednesday twice.